Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name. Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or Else Media.
The following episode will contain the names of people and places set in the fictional world of the Hyborian Age. Furthermore, if I am unable to find these names spoken aloud on YouTube or in an audiobook, they are names that I will certainly pronounce incorrectly in almost every single instance. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that's treading the jeweled thrones of Hyboria beneath its sneakered feet, one comic book at a time. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and here's a little tip for all y'all out there. Never steal from a wizard. It's a bad idea. I mean, a wizard's not just going to chase you down and take back their coin purse while they're giving you the rough side of their tongue. Oh no, that is not how wizards roll. A wizard will curse your stolen loot, you know, like turn it into snakes or something. And then they're just going to sit back and laugh while you're freaking out and running around in circles, arms flailing about frantically as you try to avoid being bitten by all them snakes. Meanwhile, the wizard is probably summoning a small army of guards, or even worse, a passel of ornery demons. So, yeah, don't do it. Do not steal from wizards. Unless, of course, you happen to be Conan. I mean, stealing from wizards? Shit, that's just another Tuesday for our boy Conan. And hey, speaking of which, today on this very episode, we're going to be talking about Conan the Barbarian number 32, in which, guess what? Conan steals from a wizard. This issue sports a cover date of November 1973, though it hit the stands in August. It sold for just 20 cents, and it is entitled Flame Winds of Lost Kitai. It was written by Roy Thomas, with pencils by John Buscema, inks by Ernie Chan, the letters were by John Costanza, and Glynis Ween was the colorist.
Into the boat!
Conan still enlisted as a soldier in the Turanian army, and his latest mission comes courtesy of Naram Bey, his boss in Agrippur, who sends him to spy on the Khitan city of Wan Tengri to see if it's ready for conquest. Smuggled into town by a shepherd, Conan immediately makes himself at home by paying the shepherd, then reimbursing himself by swiping a purse from a passerby. This was a rookie mistake because the city's magical flame wind snitches on him, shouting his location to the guards. After a classic Conan-style chase, our Cimmerian slips away and visits Teason Hugh, a local contact, hoping to cash in the stolen gems. Bad news, however, the purse's original owner is a wizard, and wizards don't play fair. The gems vanish, replaced by an angry viper. Conan's solution? Slice first, and then ask questions. Well, never. Unfortunately, the ruckus draws the guards back to him, and so Conan ducks into Teason Hugh's harem chamber, where he lingers, wink wink, with the local ladies. One of them, a beautiful blonde, offers him an escape route, a secret passage under the pool. Sounds simple, right? Wrong. Turns out she's not a lady at all, but a tentacled sea monster with a flair for betrayal. She drags Conan underwater, entangles him, and stings him with her suckers until he finally frees his sword and cuts her down. Gasping for air, Conan swims toward the light and crawls out of a pool on the far end of the estate. Exhausted and battered, he collapses, blissfully unaware of the shadowy figure now creeping toward him. And that, folks, is what we call a cliffhanger. All right, so this is the first of a three-part tale that's based on a short story that was first published in June of 1939 in an issue of a magazine called Unknown. Oh, and it wasn't a Conan story, nor was it even written by Robert E. Howard. No, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai is based on the story Flame Winds by Norval W. Page, which starred the famous yet mythical Christian patriarch, priest, and king, Prester John, who is said to live at some point between the 12th and 17th centuries, which is a rather large window of time. See, if you remember from the last episode when I talked about Roy Thomas, then Marvel editor-in-chief, and of course, the dude that wrote all these Conan comics, well, he had been trying to get the rights to adapt the Lynn Carter and L. Sprague DeCamp stories for the comic. And while Carter was receptive, DeCamp had been dragging his feet. This meant that for Conan the Barbarian number 31, the issue we talked about in the previous episode, Roy had to write something new for the flashback scene rather than use DeCamp's The Thing in the Crypt as he had hoped to do. Well, the same thing sort of happened here with this issue, Conan the Barbarian number 32. I guess Roy had planned on using Carter and DeCamp's Conan story, The Curse of the Monolith, which has King Yildiz of Turin send Conan on a mission into the Far East. But DeCamp and his dragon feet put the kibosh on another Roy Thomas plan, and old Roy had to come up with something else. Well, unlike with the previous issue, in which Roy just wrote up something new, our intrepid Conan scribe instead made a deal with the copyright holders of Norval Page's Flame Winds and used that as the basis for not only this story, but the stories in the next two issues as well, which I believe is a first here in this comic. I mean, we've had original Conan tales written by Roy Thomas. We've had tales adapted from the original Robert E. Howard Conan stories. We've had one tale so far adapted from a Lynn Carter story. And we've had tales adapted from other Robert E. Howard stories and poems that did not feature Conan in any way. But I believe this is the first time that we, not only do we have a tale that's adapted from a story that doesn't feature Conan, but it's a story that wasn't even written by Robert E. Howard. So, yeah, that's kind of weird, isn't it?
It's weird. That is weird. You're right.
Now, I haven't read Flame Winds, not yet. I mean, I figured I'd wait until I finished reading issues 33 and 34 so that I can get the whole tale with Conan in it before reading the full version that these comics were based on. That way, I don't get spoiled for anything coming up in issues 33 and 34, which, yeah, makes me a pretty smart dude.
Steven's a genius.
One last thing, real quick. Juan Tengri, or however you want to pronounce it, the name of the city in this issue, that is also the nickname given to Prester John by Norval W. Page. So in his stories, however many there were, I think there were two, he also refers to Prester John as Hurricane John and Juan Tengri. So yeah, Roy took that and made it the name of the city instead. Pretty smart, Roy. Ah, boy. Anyway, folks, grab up your copies of Conan the Barbarian number 32 and hold on tight, because we are about to dive. All right, so we have another Gil Kane cover here. It's got Conan underwater with a great big old dagger, and he's wrestling with this sea creature that, based on the cover, looks kind of like a cross between a mermaid, or if you had a mermaid with the bottom half being an octopus instead of the bottom half being a fish. Though she doesn't have any arms. Her arms are just the tentacles, and she's got like sharp frickin' vampire teeth on the cover. And then it has the words, Man battles monster in a watery grave. And then you also get the title, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai, here on the cover. It's a pretty nice cover. It's very green. It's a green cover. Not sure why I'm pointing it out that it's green, but it's very green. I guess it's supposed to be the green brackish water that Conan and this beautiful yet horrible looking sea creature are wrestling around in. But yeah, it's all right. It's an okay cover. I like that you can see that obviously it looks as if Conan is almost out of breath, but he's still just really grappling with this creature lady thing. And he's even got like a handful of her hair. He's grabbing her by the top of the head, like he's getting ready to plunge this freaking dagger into her head or into her heart or somewhere in that area. Nice cover. I enjoy it. We get into the issue and we get a splash page of Conan shirtless as normal. He's got his green trunks on. He's had these, it's kind of like a skort, I would assume. It looks like a little skirt. And frankly, I don't know if he's wearing anything under the skirt, which makes one of the upcoming panels in this issue very uncomfortable. But in this splash page, he's standing there shirtless in his boots and his little green skirt, and he's holding his sword. He's kind of posing. He's looking menacing. And behind him is a ornate flame-covered dragon, like a Chinese-style dragon. Gives you the title to the story here on the opening splash page, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai. And then it tells you, beginning one of the most amazing, most fear-fraught Conan epics ever. Which sounds like quite a bit of hyperbole, but we'll reserve judgment until after we finish the three issues. The splash page also tells you that this story was freely adapted from the novel Flame Winds by Norval Page, and that it's used by permission of Condé Nast, which is the copyright holder of the story. I don't know if Condé Nast is the name of a person or if it's a publishing company. I just don't know. And if you do, let me know, because I like to know stuff.
I don't know. Don't ask me.
So as we get into the story, we are introduced to the land of Kitai. We're in the east, and most notably in the city or outside the city of Wan Tengri. Something really weird is going on. There is they describe it as a single sweet piercing note that swims through the deepening twilight. It's kind of like an alarm, a warning, and it's telling everybody ultimately to come back into the city, the safety inside the walls of the city. And everybody is hustling. You have fishermen out in their boats, out on the lake, and they're just freaking sailing as fast as they can toward the harbor so they could get into the city. You have slaves outside the city who have been picking the dream lotus, and they have like these overseers that are whipping them to try to get them back inside, which seems fairly unnecessary. I think they're all pretty eager to get inside. Whatever this alarm is ringing out for, everyone is much more interested in being inside the city than being outside. And then we meet this shepherd who, well, he's leading an ox-drawn cart. It's got two oxes that are pulling this big cart full of wool. One of the captions points out that the man seems to be alone, but soon we see him whispering to the cart, and we learn that Conan is in the cart buried within this big giant heap of wool.
Oh, hi, Conan. How are you?
He's telling Conan that they are very, very close to the city, and Conan is in a foul mood. He's buried, you know, completely by all this wool, so it can't be very comfortable in there. Apparently, it's quite stifling and hot, and he kind of gives this shepherd the business for making him, you know, go through this, and the guy's like, chill, dude, chill, settle down. We're very close. And he says,
near Wan Tengri, the very wind has ears.
And it's at this point that this voice, described as a thin and sibilant voice, that just floats on the air. So it's kind of like a mystical PA system or something. And it's telling everybody to get their asses into the city, basically. And it seems to be talking directly to this shepherd. And the only reason I assume that is because, well, the voice on the wind, it says,
"Hasten, slaves, or feel the breath of the flame wind."
And the shepherd almost kind of bows and responds,
"I hear and obey, masters."
And then they start heading toward the city, and the guy is still whispering to Conan, who at one point whispers back that he is basically anxious to find the throat that called him slave. So Conan, you know, they hear this voice, "Hasten, slaves, or feel the breath of the flame wind." Conan assumes that the voice is referring to him, that it's talking to the both of them, and it knows that Conan is there, which, I don't know, you think would be a little alarming to the two of them, but I don't know why else he would say that. It's kind of a weird little scene here, because I kind of get the feeling that Conan just assumed that when this voice said, "Hasten, slaves," that the voice was talking to both him and the shepherd, whereas I just assumed it was just like kind of like a general announcement to everybody still outside the city. But Conan doesn't seem to think so. And if that's the case, then that means the voice knows that Conan is there, hidden amongst the wool. And we know, or at least we learn a little bit later, that the voice, wherever the voice comes from, whatever has produced this voice, whoever the voice belongs to can see things, because it points out when Conan is doing some bad within the city. So I don't know. I would assume that if the voice, again, whatever is behind this voice, if it knew that Conan was buried in the wool in this cart, then maybe it would also alert the guards that this shepherd is trying to sneak somebody into the city. So I don't know. I don't know how to reconcile the voice in this scene. I'm going to assume that it's a general announcement that the voice is making, a general worry, and Conan is just kind of saying, well, obviously the voice is talking to everybody outside the city, that, you know, everyone that's trying to get in, and it refers to everyone as a slave. And since I'm one of these people, whether the voice knows I'm here or not, that meant that the voice was calling me a slave as well. And that just pisses me off. I don't know. I think that's kind of a stretch. It's kind of weird.
That is weird. You're right.
Anyway, the shepherd is stopped at the front gate by a guard. The guard is a bit suspicious of the shepherd with the ox cart. He's got a name, by the way, the shepherd. He's got a name. They just haven't given it yet. And I should actually back up here for a second, because when we talked about the voice, it mentioned the flame winds. And the shepherd, when we first meet him, when we see him with his ox cart, he's yelling at the two oxen, calling them brain-bereft donkeys, or brothers of the brain-bereft donkey, and says, basically tells the donkeys that they're donkeys, basically tells the oxen that they have to get inside
before the devil winds blow in from Karakoram, the desert of black sands.
Now, I'll just say this right up front. The story is called Flame Winds of Los Kitai. They mention the flame winds a few times in the issue, and we see that the sky looks like it's on fire throughout this issue once it actually starts. And we know that whatever these flame winds are, they're dangerous, or at least dangerous to anybody who might be outside the city when the sky erupts into flame, which seems to happen at night. Beyond that, however, we're not given any information about this phenomenon called the flame winds of Los Kitai. So I'm assuming that in either issues 33 or 34, that maybe they'll give us a bit more information. But until now, we're outside the city. We're with the shepherd. He's got a big cart full of wool. Conan is buried inside the wool. He's hiding. We don't know why just yet, as far as the story is concerned. But a guard stops him. He's suspicious, and he starts plunging this big, long spear of his into the wool. you know, thinking that if there is, I guess he assumes that there's a possibility that the shepherd is trying to smuggle somebody in, or maybe he thinks that the shepherd's smuggling some animals in or something alive within the wool. So he sticks it with his spear a couple of times. We get kind of a couple of cool panels of Conan within the wool and the spear narrowly missing his face, just sliding right by his face without, you know, leaving a scratch. We see Conan within the wool clutching his sword, ready to throw down in case he does get stuck by that spear.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
And now, back to Hither Came Conan.
And then, before the guard lets the shepherd in, he gives one last try, sticks the wool one more time with the spear, which does actually slice through a bit of Conan's leg, his upper thigh, drawing blood, and Conan just kind of grimaces. He's sweating his ass off, buried under this wool, and now his leg is cut up and bleeding, and he's grimacing. He's keeping it together because he is one tough son of a bitch. Besides, we learn here he's on a mission. Now, before we get to what his mission is, the guard, of course, no longer suspicious, thinking that if something was in there in that cart alive, that it would have screamed or something by now, based on all the times that he stuck his spear in there. So he lets the shepherd into the city. This is when we learn Conan's mission. So we get a bit of a flashback. Conan is sitting down having a meal with the commander of the garrison who had asked Conan to come see him. The guy's name is Naram Bey. He'd asked Conan to come see him because he was recommended. Conan was recommended by Captain Malthus. And if you remember, that's the guy who led Conan's group in the previous issue, the campaign to stamp out the rebellion by the Hillmen. This is the guy that was going to do battle with the champion of the Hillmen to try to free the rest of the Turanian soldiers. And Conan cracked him on the back of the head, knocked him out so Conan could take his place. And obviously, Captain Malthus doesn't harbor any ill feelings toward Conan. Otherwise, he may not have recommended Conan to the garrison commander, Naram Bey. Or maybe he's still pissed at Conan and he assumes that whatever mission Naram Bey, you know, Naram Bey rolls up to Malthus and he says, "Hey, I got a mission that is very dangerous. I need you to volunteer somebody who's a tough guy, because whoever goes, there's probably a good chance that they may not come back. So they got to be good, but they got to be expendable." And Malthus is like, "Well, you know, Conan pissed me off recently by cracking me in the back of the head and knocking me out. So why don't you take him?" But either way, Conan is here. The commander is telling Conan about his mission, which is just that he needs somebody to go into the city of Wan Tengri, which is on the westernmost fringes of Kitai. King Yildiz, he likes to go out there and conquer places, and he's looking at Kitai, and he's looking at that city of Wan Tengri, because it's right there, closest to Turin. But rumor has it that a group of wizards had recently taken over the city, and since then, it sounds like they probably had some spies in the city at one point, but since the wizards took over, they've heard nothing out of the city. And so they want somebody to go in, take a look around, see what's going on, and then come back and report just to say whether or not they think that the city is ripe for an invasion. And they have chosen Conan to go do this, and he has promised gold and women as his reward. Now, I should mention that in the home here of the garrison commander of Narim Bey, he is, again, they're having dinner. They're not sitting at a table. They're sitting on the floor, you know, sitting amongst pillows and whatnot. And Narim Bey has a woman with him, his paramour, his lady friend, his woman of the night, whatever you want to call her. I think they call her, refer to her as a paramour in the book. Her name is Amytis, A-M-Y-T-I-S, Amytis, Amytis, I don't know. But when Narim Bey offers gold and women for Conan, as you know, as his reward, Conan tells him that he'll take the gold, but he chooses his own women. And he kind of looks at the Lady Amytis, kind of like, yeah, if I wanted you, I would get you. I don't need this dude here to give you to me. Because Conan's kind of like T-Rex. T-Rex doesn't want to be fed. T-Rex wants to hunt. Conan doesn't want women given to him. He wants to get the women himself. But I wanted to point out one panel here in this scene where Conan's sitting down to dinner with Narim Bey and his paramour, the Lady Amytis. Because there's a moment here, there's one panel here where Conan is sitting there on the floor. He's kind of sitting on a step. There's almost like a very shallow conversation pit in the middle of this room. It's only about a step lower than the rest of the room. And so Conan is sitting at the edge of that with one foot up on the step and one foot in the other tier, whatever you'd call it. And his legs are spread wide open. And both Narim Bey and the Lady Amytis are basically staring directly into Conan's crotch. And so if what he is wearing is a skirt, and by all indications, based on how everything is drawn, based on every other panel in this issue and every panel of every issue in which Conan has been wearing this garment, it does look like a skirt. And again, we don't know if he's got anything on underneath it, because they do a really good job, especially here in this scene, in this panel, where his legs are spread wide open. They just have a great big old solid black shadow over his crotch. So yeah, I would have to assume that both Narim Bey and Lady Amytis are just looking at Conan's junk, that his junk is just there on display. And Conan obviously doesn't care, and the other two don't seem to care either.
He's coming out of his shorts.
What?
The man is showing brain.
Which means that, I don't know, Conan's junk isn't very impressive, maybe? Could you infer that? Probably not. I'm sure Conan has some mighty junk. I mean, you know, because he's Conan, right? Why wouldn't he?
You're so big and so well-grown.
Anyway, with the flashback done, we go back to the shepherd, who we learn at this point, his name is Kassar. Shepherd's inside the city. He tells Conan that they're safe, and Conan comes out of the wool, you know, out of the cart, jumps out of the cart. And feeling generous, he hands over a bag of gold to Kassar, telling him that it's the gold that he was paid by the Turanians. And yeah, just tells him to spend it wisely. Hands it over, tells him to spend it wisely, and then heads on into the city. At this point, the flame winds are out. They seem to be emanating from a tower within the city, the highest tower of the city. The flames seem to be coming out of that tower and then filling up the sky above them. Conan then, at that point, he sees that as he's creeping about the city. There's really nobody around because they've all taken shelter. But he's starting to realize that maybe he shouldn't have given away all his money, that he was feeling magnanimous, I think is the word they use in the book, and just happens to notice some dude out walking the streets, like one lone guy who is running a little late from wherever he was. He didn't get the alert in time, and you know, so he's still outside, and Conan sees him and says, "All right, well, this will be the answer to my money problems." And he jumps the guy, knocks him out, steals his purse, And as he's doing so, that voice, that mystical PA voice, wherever it's coming from, this time they describe it as a sibilant whisper, but it calls out,
"Remain where you stand, slave, until the guardsmen come."
I don't know if that's a good, I don't know if that was a good auditory depiction of sibilant, a sibilant whisper. I did my best, folks. What do you want from me? But basically, the voice, whatever it is, calls out to the guards. "Hey, there's a barbarian here. He's stealing money from people. Come get him." But at the same time, as it's doing that, you know, Conan is crouched over the unconscious form of this dude that he just robbed. And the flames, the flame winds that have been in the sky, they actually dip down lower, like they're trying to grab Conan, like the voice and the flames, they're one and the same. And as it's alerting the guards, it's also trying to stop Conan as well. That's kind of what it looks like, slightly. Conan, on the other hand, is like, "Screw this," and starts to run. The guards start to chase him, and Conan scrambles up a wall because, of course, he's a Cimmerian, and he can climb like crazy. In fact, I believe in the issue it says that that Cimmerians, they learn to climb before they learn to crawl, living up in them rocky hills and whatnot there in Cimmeria. But the guards can't chase him up this wall. It's a very, the wall is very tall, tall wall, rhyming words. You know, it's at least three people high, possibly four. And the guards, they can't climb it. They're weighed down with a lot of armor, but they know what's on the other side of that wall, and they know how to get to the other side of that wall. And so that's what they do. They scramble around. They get to the other side of the wall. Conan is not there. And the guards are very upset about that. Not because they feel like they didn't do their duty, but because they now fear that the wizards will punish them. Conan, however, having escaped, he finds the home of Teezin Hugh. Kassar, the shepherd, had sent Conan to Teezin Hugh. I guess this dude, Teezin Hugh, is the contact within the city. That's who Conan needs to go talk to, or at least he's a fence, maybe. Because what Conan tries to do, he comes to see Teezin Hugh. He tells him that Kassar sent him and that he has a purse full of jewels that he needs to turn into money, basically. And so Teezin Hugh is sitting down. He's kind of a fat, bald guy, and he's sitting down with Conan, and he's looking at the jewels, and he dumps some of them out into his hand, and suddenly they disappear. And Hugh is like, "Whoa, dude, did you steal this from a wizard?" Because that's what wizards do with their stuff. They enchant them so that if you steal from them, it disappears and comes back to them. Conan thinks that the guy's full of shit. He thinks that the guy took the jewels that he just put in his hand and he's palmed them, you know, giving him the old sleight of hand trick there to steal the jewels for himself. And so Conan knocks him to the ground. He draws his sword, or at least a big dagger. He knocks him to the ground and he calls him three names. He screams them at this guy. Three insulting names: liar, thief, and businessman. The third one's the businessman. To Conan, apparently being a businessman is just as bad as being a liar and a thief. And you know what, Conan? I kind of agree. Anyway, he forces Hugh to strip down naked to make sure that the guy hasn't hidden Conan's jewels among his clothes or among his person anywhere. And he finds that the guy hasn't. And, you know, the dude points out again, "Well, that's because there's nothing there for me to hide because the wizard took him back." Conan points out that, "Well, yeah, but there's still more in the bag, see?" And he opens the bag, he upends it into his palm, and instead of the jewels coming out, a freaking snake falls out of the bag. It's a viper, a red viper. Conan, before allowing the snake to land in his hand, he tosses. Well, actually, he may have, because it looks like, because there's one panel where he's holding the bag open over his hand. The next panel has the snake coming out of it, and Conan's yelling, "Krom!" And then there's a third panel where Conan is throwing the bag and the snake into the air. And then the fourth panel, Conan is using his knife to slice the snake in half. And he actually says something pretty funny at the same time, because he says,
"A viper where rubies were, but I make my own kind of magic. You see, where there was one viper, now there are two."
Conan, he should go on stage with that stuff, man. He shouldn't be funny. Conan should not be funny. He's already good looking. He's muscular. He gets all the ladies. He can do everything. And now he's funny at the same time. That's not fair. Anyway, Conan is still angry that these jewels disappeared. He still doesn't quite trust Teasin Hugh that the guy is telling him the truth. And he even wonders maybe that, because here's the thing. Hugh tells Conan, as he's explaining this whole thing with the wizards, or wizards and the way they make their jewels and money disappear if people try to steal them, he basically explains, you know, that the wizards that control the city, there's seven of them, but nobody knows who they are. No one has ever seen the wizards in person. Nobody knows their true identities. And so Conan at this point is wondering that, well, if nobody knows who the wizards are, maybe you're one of them. And so he places the tip of his knife up to Teasin Hugh's throat, tells him that everybody knows that only enchanted steel can harm a sorcerer. And he's basically telling him that he's going to slit the dude's throat. And if he survives, then obviously he's a wizard, because Conan's knife is not enchanted. But if he dies, then Conan will feel bad about that, because he knows that the guy is telling the truth and that he was an honest man. He doesn't get very far, however, with his threats, because then suddenly the guards who have been hunting him down, they burst into the room. They found Conan, who they refer to as a slave. Conan, again, not happy to be called a slave, and he throws the dagger and it embeds itself in the heart of the guard who enters the room first. So that guy's dead. Conan draws his sword and then they just start fighting. And it's a wonderful scene. I love John Buscema when it comes to these kind of fights, because first of all, he draws his sword, and then there's just this panel where Conan is just chopping this guy, like, on his shoulder. So we have to assume that he just chopped this guy's arm off. We see Conan's basically facing the camera, and the guard is facing Conan, so the guard's back is to us. And so he's blocking most of Conan. We can see, though, that Conan has basically chopped him there in that area between his neck and his shoulder. And we don't see the aftermath of what that chop did, but we can assume that the guy lost his arm. But then Conan just wades into them. This is the kind of shit I like, because this panel following the one where Conan chops the guy in the shoulder, he still clutching his sword. He barrels into, it looks like, three of them, possibly four. Is that one, two? I don't know. Could be four of them, five, maybe at least four. Three, four, or five. And it's a wonderful panel, because he's just, even though it's Conan literally grappling with like three or four guys, it's drawn in such a way that you can tell that Conan still has the upper hand, that he's the one that's in control and he's the one that's kicking their asses. And when all is said and done, he takes a few of them out. There's still a couple of them that are getting back up off the floor. Conan pulls like a curtain off the wall, throws it on top of the few that are pulling themselves to their feet. And again, I love this kind of stuff, because Conan could have just, you know, started, he could have just, you know, just went at them with his sword, right? And they could have had a big sword fight and Conan would have killed them. And, you know, he could have finished them off in traditional sword and sorcery style, just a big old sword fight. But instead, to make it interesting, he grabs a curtain off the wall, or maybe it's a big tablecloth. I don't know. It's a big, giant piece of fabric. He throws it on top of these guys, and then he picks up a table, and he smashes it down on top of them, maybe more than once. I don't know. We see it hit these dudes under this big freaking curtain, and the table shatters. And so, yeah, maybe he didn't kill him, but they're not getting back up. At this point, Conan looks around, and Teasin Hugh is gone. That immediately makes Conan distrust the guy even more. And so Conan sets out
to try to find the guy. He starts stalking around the dude's house looking for him until he stumbles upon like a big room with a big pool in it. Like a, I don't know, not a swimming pool exactly. It's more of a big bathing pool. There's a statue of a fish with water coming out of its mouth, pouring into the pool. And then around the pool are half-naked ladies. These are T's and Hugh's women, his harem, and they are expecting Conan. They tell him that T's and Hugh asked them to welcome Conan and told Conan to make his home his own. And so Conan's kind of like, all right, I guess I can hang out for a little bit. In the meantime, there is off in one area of this room, like off in near one wall or something, there's a bunch of plants and reeds and whatnot, and there's somebody skulking around within these plants wearing like a hooded cloak. Don't know who that is. Conan doesn't seem to be all that interested because, you know, half-naked ladies. And one of them comes in and gives Conan a bunch of jewels. Conan's pretty happy about getting these jewels, even though he points out that if they were or are a wizard's jewels, they're just going to disappear anyway. And he's like, whatever.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages. And now back to Hither Came Conan.
Then this blonde girl in like a see-through robe walks in and she tells him that she knows the way out. If he wants to follow her, she can get him out of the house. And she goes into the pool, dives under the water, and disappears. And so Conan, who at this point, he's wearing a shirt. You know, I mentioned in the splash page that he was shirtless, but in regard to the story itself, he's been wearing a sleeveless shirt this entire time with his skirt and his boots. But he takes the shirt off, he takes the boots off, and he dives into the water with his sword still strapped to his waist. And he follows this girl deeper into the water. There's a tunnel under the water. They go swimming through the tunnel. Conan, apparently, he knows that his lungs are very impressive. He has developed his lungs to, you know, to be able to hold his breath for longer than your normal man. He can hold his breath for at least 3 minutes underwater. And he's not too concerned about where this woman is taking him because he feels that obviously she's going to run out of breath too. So she obviously knows where she's going and that they're not going to be underwater long enough for it to make much of a difference. And yet while they're in this tunnel, she stops and she turns around and they just start making out underwater. Conan again is just kind of thinking, obviously the way out is very near or she wouldn't pause to do this. But you know what? If a hot looking blonde girl is going to want to make out with me underwater, I'm going to do it, which I'm sorry, Conan, that's pretty stupid. And not just because you're in a tunnel underwater, you don't know how to get out. The fact that you're wasting time under there just so you can get some smooches from some strange woman, that's pretty dumb. But she, of course, turns into a freaking monster. And I'm not a big fan of the way this monster is drawn within the book compared to how she looked on the cover. Because basically, John Buscema, it's like he turned her body into a lump of just gray, like a lump of gray clay. And rather than looking like an octopus, her arms have turned into tentacles and her legs have turned into tentacles. So her torso is still there. It's just a really weird, lumpy gray thing with tentacles coming out where the arms and shoulders should be and tentacles coming out where the legs should be. And she still has her regular head with her blonde hair, which her face is flesh colored. So despite the fact that the monster portion of her body is all gray and lumpy and tentacled, her head and face are just normal human affair, basically. But she starts wrestling with Conan underwater and he is trying to fight back, but her eyes have kind of this she kind of hypnotizes him, because at first he doesn't want to strike out at her because he's still kind of, even though she's turned into a monster, he still thinks of her as a woman. And he's never, you know, struck out against a woman like that with a sword and whatnot. But eventually he is able to overcome whatever spell this woman has put on him. And he slices off one of her tentacles only to see it grow immediately back. She pulls him deeper and deeper into the water. And finally, he closes his eyes so he can stop looking into her eyes, which again are hypnotizing him and making him slow. He closes his eyes, lashes out, and he cuts off her head, and blood just fills the water. Of course, in the book, in the comic, it's black because, again, Comics Code Authority, you can show a huge cloud of blood, you know, the way blood is in water. You can show that, but only if it's black, which, again, for me, makes it even creepier. Now, when he does kill her, when he cuts off her head, the rest of her body sinks to the bottom of whatever this underground underwater cavern thing is. And Conan is covered, his bare skin is covered in these like suction marks that from the suckers on her tentacles. And he's running out of air and he just starts swimming like a crazy person. And immediately he sees the way out and he swims toward it. He bursts out of the water. He's in another area of the house, like possibly outside of the house, an outside area of the pool where that connected to the inside pool. And he is just so exhausted at this point from nearly suffocating to death, from fighting a octopus lady monster thing underwater, that he pulls himself out of this pool and he's exhausted. He passes out right there on the ground in front of this pool and doesn't notice as he's laying there that there's a shadowy figure standing on this roof looking down at him. And it climbs down off of this roof almost like a monkey or an ape. I think the narration says,
"Thus he does not see the twisted, humpbacked figure framed against the flickering light, glaring down at him like some apish gargoyle. He does not see when, startlingly, the gargoyle moves and clambers down tiling and turret like some jungle-born simian to slouch monstrously toward him here in a place 5,000 miles from the craggy land where Conan was born and where he may, perhaps, die."
And with that, we are told next, into the arena, and that's where this issue ends on this cliffhanger. I will point out, however, to me, it looks like Conan has one eye open, but you don't see the white of his eye, and I don't know, maybe it's not open. But yeah, we don't know what this thing is, person that's creeping up on him, but based on the captions there at the end, it just might kill him. Though I think that we have read comics like this long enough to know that there's probably a good chance that when we get into the next issue, this is probably a friend, or at least someone who will quickly become a friend. I don't know. We'll see. We'll find out when we look at issue number 33, Death and Seven Wizards. It's a great name. Anyway, this was it was fun. I enjoyed this issue. I liked it a lot. I feel like I should do some type of review at this point in the episode, you know, the art was blah, 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 and the story was blue, blue, blue. But I mean, really, I've never been good at that part when it comes to these kinds of episodes, or when it comes to episodes talking about issues and books and stories and movies and junk like that.
That came out a bit glib, didn't it?
You know, I can tell you if I liked it or if I didn't like it. And I'm usually pretty good about telling you why I didn't like it, but I'm not very good about explaining why I liked something. But this story really, I mean, when it comes to all the other Conan stories that we've read so far, it's fairly standard. It's your standard Conan story. There's nothing that makes it stand out over any of the other stories. Not really. It's your average Conan tale, but that just means it's fun. There were some fun moments in it. I like the fact that he took out the last three guards by covering them with a big blanket and then breaking a giant table over the top of them. I like that Conan is still young and dumb enough that he will pause underwater in an underwater tunnel to make out with a pretty blonde girl, despite the fact that he's running out of air, but he's still thinking with his junk. And I like the fact that his junk was on display at one point to two other people in the room, and nobody seemed to care. That's just the way it was, apparently, in Hyboria at the time, or at least in Turin at the time. People's junk just swinging hither and yon, and nobody giving a damn one way or the other.
Hey, buddy. This is a family place. Put the mouse back in the house.
The art, you know, John Buscema, Ernie Chan, what do you want me to say? It's really pretty stuff to look at. John Buscema is a wonderful storyteller. He really does things with his characters that, you know, just make the panels, it makes them stand out. You know, they're not your average, I don't know how to explain it. He's just, they're very dynamic. He's really good about, you know, you got somebody in a panel, even if they're just sitting at a table, he doesn't put the camera in the a place you'd expect it to be. He doesn't pose the figure in a way that you would expect them to be. It always seems like there's shit just ready to kick off in any panel with any of these people that, you know, that action is just always a half a second away. And I dig that about him. And Ernie Chan really compliments Buscema's art. The two of them have obviously created something pretty special with these issues. But at the same time, because, you know, this is the art that we're seeing over the last couple of issues, and we'll see for a number of issues going forward, really about the only thing you can say about it when you compare it to some of these other issues is that it's standard Conan artwork. It's a standard Conan story. And that doesn't make it bad. That doesn't mean it's average. That doesn't mean it's bland. It just means that it's still good shit, that you're still getting good stuff here. You're still seeing some great panels and some epic battles and some just great fighting, some great action, some real good shit. What else do you want me to say? But yeah, that was Conan the Barbarian issue number 32. And that is all I have to say about it. Is there anything you'd like to add? Did you dig it? Did you hate it? Did I get anything wrong? Was everything right? Let me know. Feedback at hithercameconan.com. But hey, folks, that's not it. We're not done. There's just one more bit left before I let you go. Let's do a little historic Hyboria. And because we're in the East, in the mysterious land of Kitai, well, that's what we're going to talk about. Kitai, a realm shrouded in mystery and rich with ancient lore, stands as one of the most enigmatic lands of the Hyborian Age. Nestled far to the east, its origins trace back to the pre-cataclysmic age, a time when its people and culture began to flourish. Kitai became synonymous with knowledge, its traditions steeped in ancient wisdom that, even in Conan's time, cast a long shadow over the world. The Khitans carried a deep conviction of their cultural superiority, which shaped their worldview and policies. To them, the Western lands and their inhabitants were merely barbarians, a term not reserved solely for Conan and his ilk, but applied broadly to any foreigner. This sense of isolation was reinforced by the land's natural barriers. To the west stretched the vast Wuhan Desert, an inhospitable expanse where nomadic tribes posed a deadly threat to travelers. Yet the Khitans took no chances, constructing a great wall to further secure their borders. This massive fortification symbolized not only their desire to repel invaders, but also their determination to remain apart from the chaos of the Western world. Despite their efforts to remain isolated, however, Kitai's history was not devoid of conflict. At some point, the realm became embroiled in what Turin remembered as the Great War with Kitai. Details of this conflict are sparse, but its legacy is one of immense loss for the Khitans, with massive casualties staining the annals of their history. The geography of Khitai is as diverse as its history. Within the Great Wall lies a land of extraordinary contrasts. Fertile plains, urban centers, bamboo jungles, and lush forests coexist with great deserts, active volcanoes, and the ominously named lava hills. Paikang, the capital and crown jewel of Khitai, flourished at the end of a major trade route. This bustling city-state reigned supreme, its marketplaces offering treasures as varied as silk, spices, jade, and even magical artifacts. The southern reaches of Khitai held the mysterious Lost Jungle, a region once home to the alien Yag Kosha and his followers, adding yet another layer to the land's storied past. Further west, at the edge of the Wuhan Desert, stood Wan Tengri, Khitai's westernmost city. Governed by a secretive coterie of wizards, the city bore an air of mysticism and menace. At its heart loomed the tallest and most foreboding of towers, from which flame-like winds spilled out into the night, lighting the city in an eerie glow. The wizards of Wan Tengri enforced a strict curfew, their fiery dominion ensuring that the city's nocturnal hours were as tightly controlled as its mystical secrets. This combination of sorcery and structure made Wan Tengri a gateway of both peril and wonder, a fitting sentinel on Khitai's remote frontier. Khitai's flora and fauna further illustrate its exotic nature. The Lost Jungle was home to the Black Lotus, a poisonous plant shrouded in infamy, feared for its lethal potency and coveted for its mysterious otherworldly properties. Gray apes prowled the jungles, while their silver ape cousins roamed the bamboo forests. In the lava hills, red apes ruled, their fiery domain echoing the volcanic activity around them. The deserts and volcanic regions were also home to the Skiri, a species known for their hive cities, blending the alien and the terrestrial into a uniquely Hyborian tableau. Religion in Khitai was as multifaceted as its landscape. Unlike the state religions of other empires, Khitai embraced a staggering diversity of deities and rituals. The Khitans worshipped a pantheon said to number in the thousands, or perhaps 9,000, depending on who told the tale. Gods and demons alike found their devotees, from Cheng Ho, goddess of the moon, to Yun, whose followers offered prayers and incense. Practices ranged from the benign to the macabre, with some sects engaging in human sacrifice. The alien, Yag Kosha himself, was revered in the Lost Jungle, his presence a haunting reminder of Khitai's otherworldly connections. Khitai's legacy extended far beyond the Hyborian Age. Robert E. Howard conceived it as an analog to China, drawing from the name Cathay and the rich tapestry of East Asian history. Paikang, often linked to modern Beijing, serves as a reminder of the real-world inspirations that fueled Howard's imagination. Yet Khitai is not merely a stand-in for historical China. It's a land infused with the magic, mystery, and danger that define the Hyborian world. As we delve into Conan's adventures into Khitai, it becomes clear that this realm is not just a backdrop, but a living, breathing character in its own right. From its imposing Great Wall to its bustling markets and untamed jungles, Khitai captures the essence of the exotic and the arcane. And while Conan may have traversed its deserts and jungles, encountering its people and creatures, there remains an air of secrecy, an allure that ensures Khitai will forever be a land of legend.
Everybody out!
On the next episode of Hither Came Conan, our favorite Sumerian crawls from the watery depths, only to find himself plunged into the heart of Wan Tengri's seedy underbelly. In a city ruled by seven sinister wizards, Conan discovers a thieves' guild in shambles, a shepherd in peril, and a flame tower brimming with deadly secrets. Amidst fiery traps and magic-soaked treachery, Conan faces tigers, tongueless warriors, and a veiled woman whose identity will chill you to the bone. Can our steely thewed barbarians survive this gauntlet of death and sorcery? Find out next time when we look at Conan the Barbarian number 33, Death and Seven Wizards, published by Marvel Comics in September of 1973. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and then altered, twisted, rewritten, and added to by me. The information used in this episode comes from Wikipedia, along with Mike's Amazing World of Comics at Mike'sAmazingWorld.com and the book Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1 by Roy Thomas, which you can get now at SumeriumPress.com. The segment Historic Hyboria showcases the people, places, and/or things from the Hyborian Age of the Marvel Universe, and may not reflect the information found in any other version of Conan's world. And finally, the views and opinions expressed within this episode are mine and mine alone, and do not reflect the official policy or position of Marvel Comics, Roy Thomas, the Howard Estate, Conan, his sword, his steely thews, his many fans and supporters, and especially his god, Crom.
Crom laughs with your four winds.
So until next time, folks, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and as always, be nice to each other. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback at hithercameconan.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Hither Came Conan and every other show under the Stephen or Else Media umbrella early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes, or just go to hithercameconan.com to sign up today. Hither Came Conan is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes. Hello and welcome to Hither Came Conan. Poopity poop poop poopy poop. It's been a while since I've done this. Hello and welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that's treading the jeweled thrones of Hyboria beneath its sneak... Hello and welcome to Hither Came Conan, the poopity poop poop poop. God, it's been a while since I've done this. I'm throwing off. I'm off my game, folks. I'm off of it. The game is off. Hello and... The guard's a bit suspicious. The guard is a bit suspicious. Shishifickin, shishfickers. He does not see. When startlingly, he does not see when startlingly the gargoyle moo. Startlingly, he does not see. He does not see when startlingly, Jesus, fuck. Startlingly, he does not see when startlingly the gargoyle moves and clambers down.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Enough talk.
Great Crom.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.